This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil tackle the politics of the political extreme. We begin with a look at the struggle between piety and profanity within the modern Republican Party, and then explore Donald Trump's full embrace of January 6th, transition to Donald Trump's provocative language from last week, take a look at the Democratic Party and the protest votes against Joe Biden, and close with a game of What's More Stupid, Aaron Rodgers edition. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Phil Barker, who's a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil, welcome home.
Welcome home. Yeah. How are you doing? I haven't seen you in like 3 days.
Yes. For our listeners, Phil and I, this last weekend, were down in Florida. We went to a couple of spring training baseball games. It was fantastic. We talked a lot about political science, you know, because that's what we do when we get together. We ate some good food and explored Tampa and Florida, which is also sort of an interesting thing to do. And yeah, just enjoyed each other's company.
Yeah, the baseball games were great. Different than I expected, but really fun. The food was fantastic. Really good seafood. Yes. And Cuban food. And yeah, it was great. Florida was like, I've been to Florida many times, but I've been to like beach resorts, or I've been to like Orlando or whatever. And I felt like we saw real Florida for the first time. And it was sort of, I don't know what I imagined, but like even more so than I imagined. Yeah. It was like a stereotype or something, but it was fun to see.
It is, right? It is all Florida, right? And it is all sprawl and everything, like every stereotype of Florida we saw in multitude of ways, and some of them are endearing and some of them are annoying. So it's like when you try to drive anywhere in Tampa, it's just all stoplights and massive cars, and it's not the most well designed. You get the sense of the lack of government and lack of regulation. Yes. And we've talked about Texas oftentimes has this. There's not a lot of planning that goes into cities. And you felt the same thing in Tampa, where there's just, you know, 8-lane highways every which direction and everyone's going 18 miles an hour on all of them. But it was a good experience. We enjoyed each other. So, yeah. But now we're back. Now, you're actually on spring break. I'm back working. And we're getting close to the end of a month or so, and we're done with the school year.
That's kind of crazy. Yeah, it's before we know it, we're going to be done.
It does go fast.
I'm looking forward to a little bit of a break.
Absolutely. So, all right, we got 5 different topics this week. We're going to go through them relatively quickly. Before we do, Phil, you want to remind everybody how they can stay connected with us?
Yeah, thepoliticslab.com is our webpage. You can go there, find all of our old episodes. And as is always the case, you can go and click on this week's episode, and we've got 4 or 5 articles that are related to the things that we're going to be talking about. So the opening topic has a really interesting article that sort of spurred that. And then we're going to look at some data on protest votes. All of that stuff is, there's further reading at thepoliticslab.com if you want to go there.
Great website. Check it out. All right, so let's dive in. There was an article in the New York Times this week that in many ways inspired this entire episode. It was titled Piety and Profanity, The Raunchy Christians Are Here. And it looks at the contrast or evolution in political Christianity, and on the right there. The conservative Christian of today is not the evangelicals of the late 90s and early 2000s. That Christian was best captured by the Simpsons character Ned Flanders. Love Ned Flanders. Known for his cheerful sort of conservative values and never swearing, and he embraced evangelical norms against vulgarity and sexuality. Yet the New York Times notes that a quote, raunchier, outsider, boobs and booze ethos has elbowed its way into conservative power class, accelerated by the rise of Donald Trump, the declining influence of traditional religious institutions, and a shifting media landscape increasingly dominated by the looser standards of online culture, unquote. I know we see this in the more openly vulgar language used on the right, as well as the drift away from sexual piety. While there are many factors at play, it's clear that their loyalty to Trump and then sort of the way in which the right has embraced Trump has helped transform these norms on the right. The Times notes that after 8 years of Trump, quote, it is clear that the aesthetics and language and the borders of public morality in evangelical America are shifting. So if you're looking for a non-Trump example, think about Representative Lauren Boebert, who has called for an end to the separation of church and state, yet was also caught at a theater on a security camera vaping and groping her date, right? So this is the perfect contrast of what this article is talking about. Or Marjorie Taylor Greene wearing a MAGA hat and yelling at Biden during the State of the Union speech. All of this has created a curious moment where Christians are indulging more openly in what we might call public heterosexual lust. But at the same time, outrages at the rising rates of non-traditional gender and sexual identities are occurring. Phil, there's a lot of normative action going on here. What do you make of all this?
So first of all, I think this is really fascinating. My research is on sort of religious identity, and mostly in Europe. But as we kind of talk through this and think about this, I think there's so many interesting factors that come into play here, because I think it is undeniable, right? Like the fact that evangelicals have fallen in line behind Donald Trump is it has been a sort of gradual transformation. But the difference between, you know, the Republican Party of my youth that was outraged by Bill Clinton and talked about how character matters and that's like more important than anything else has become the party of Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, right? They're like the ones who are sort of leading the charge. And how that transformation has happened is remarkable. I think the stuff the article points out and that you mentioned, I think there are so many elements to this. I think the decline in sort of formal religion in America is part of that. I think the online stuff, the algorithmic aspects of it, you know, really matter as well. I think that we've talked a lot about kind of the black and white, the sort of us versus them approach to politics. I think that forgives a lot, right? When somebody's on your side, you're willing to sort of look the other way. But I also, you know, from a sort of thinking about it from research standard, I thought of a couple of things as I was reading this article, one of which is we've talked on here about the rise of populists and the rise of kind of the Trumpian form of politics. And one of the things we've talked about is the importance of political parties in sort of keeping them out, because once they enter a party, like they sort of corrupt the party from within. Like it requires, you know, when you have a populist or an anti-government or a, you know, whatever, election denier, they sort of normalize that behavior for the party as a whole. And that's why it's important to kind of hold the line against them. And I see that playing out here, not in terms of a political party, but in terms of a religion, right? As it felt like, you know, 8 years ago, conservative Christians sort of came to terms with this idea of, I don't like Donald Trump, but I will support him for some bigger cause. Yes. They opened the door to him. And what has happened since is this kind of remaking of what it means to be a Christian. If Christians support him and he is this way, then, you know, the two sort of blur in a way that it's just sort of another lesson in the danger of kind of opening your community to this sort of thinking, right? Like people are convinced they should do it for some greater cause, but we see the way it sort of corrupts or, erodes from inside.
Really interesting, right? As we think about that, and I like how you talked about it's how we understand Christianity and how those norms have shifted. And I was also thinking back to the 90s and Bill Clinton, and the argument on the Christian right was really about that. It was about morality, and it was about what kind of person you are, and that was central to it. And as I think about the balance between religion and politics for those groups, it was really more about religion than it was about politics, right? Yeah. The religion was driving it, and that religion also had political implications, but in that balance, it was really more about religion. And I think what we're seeing today is there is still that balance between religion and politics, but it's much more about the politics, especially for many of these actors. And you're absolutely right. It was a transaction that the Christian right made with Donald Trump to say, hey, you're a fighter. You are going to advocate for our causes. We don't really think you're particularly devout or pious, but we're going to support you because you're going to fight for us. And that's how it was early on. But as time has gone by, you know, Trump has had an effect. Online media has had an effect. I mean, it's not just Trump. There's a lot of things that are going on. And you've seen the transformation of that political movement to become more political, less religious, but still to speak of that religion political balance. And I found myself, I was thinking about this earlier today, and it's a point you raised. This is going to change what it means to be a Christian. Because, you know, these churches, a lot of churches are full of political evangelicals now. And then the nature of that discourse and those conversations shift. It's sort of fascinating, right? And it's moved in a vulgar is the word. That's the New York Times talks about it that way. Like, you know, profane and sexual and all of that in a particular normative way. So it's an extraordinary transition. And I thought this was a nice piece to sort of catalog that movement.
Yeah. So building off a couple of things you said, I mean, I think you mentioned a few things that are really interesting, which is that, you know, looking back at, you talked about sort of the way in which religion used to be about religion and less about politics and how that sort of shifted. And that's one of the things that was like, you know, when you look back not that long ago, 50 years ago in American politics, religious, particularly like evangelical religious groups, right, were intentionally apolitical. They stayed out of it. And the idea was, the fear was that politics would sort of corrupt the religion, right? And so we often think about like the separation of church and state is that government should stay out of you know, religious views. But the fear from the was the flip, essentially, that by embracing, you know, politics, the religion sort of opens itself up to these corrupting factors. And that's what we've seen, right? Like, you've seen this desire for political power that has, I don't know, again, has mutated American religion to some extent. And I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting, you know, this article mentions that a decline in religion is part of what explains this. But I think a decline in religion is also a response to this. Like, this is, again, getting in the weeds a little bit, but there's interesting research that has looked at like the Catholic Church in Latin America. One of the things that has been found is that in places where the church, like religious groups, established religions or really strong religions, sort of partner with government, they see opportunities to further their interests by partnering with government, by influencing policy or whatever, they're able to do that. But what happens is it comes at the cost of their ability to represent their followers or their values. Mm. So when you tie yourself to the government, you sort of limit your own ability to respond to or critique the government. And so what has happened in those places where there's this stronger tie between religion and government authority, oftentimes like religious attendance actually declines as a result. And you see that to some extent, right? What you see is not, you know, you see a religion that's not sort of practicing what it preaches. And so, of course, people are going to be turned off by that and pushed away. So, you know, it all sort of, you know, wraps itself together in really fascinating ways. One other
that's
point.
That's interesting. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead. If you want to have some response, I'll be quiet.
No, continue. I want to hear point two.
The other thing, there's a couple of other thoughts I have. One of, you were talking about like vulgarity, right? How religion is becoming increasingly vulgar. The other idea is there's this argument within like religious writing or religious research about, you know, this, all this talk about secularization, like the decline of religion in the world. But one of the sort of counter arguments is that, yes, there is always a process of secularization where people are sort of moving away from religion, but it's also offset by, some people argue, by a process of sacralization, which is essentially, it's not that people are less religious. They're just like, they hold different things in terms of like what is sort of holy or off limits. Mm-hmm. And it feels like what's happened is that religion has sort of replaced some of those core values. And what you see now is it's not that nothing is sacred. It's that certain things are sacred, but what's become sacred is like Donald Trump and winning at the election, you know, the voting booth and that sort of stuff. And that is what like is unquestionable, that can't be challenged. And it's bizarre to watch that play out, but it's still religion. It's just a shift in kind of what is important to those religious people. What do they see as, you know, the sort of off limits, holy, sacred, set apart thing. And bizarrely, Donald Trump has become that for so many people.
Well, and that's such a transformation, right? So much of the Christian nationalist movement, and even Donald Trump himself, is about going back, right? So make America great again. Let's look back to a time when things were better. But I think the reality is that world that they're looking back to is not the world that they want anymore. Yeah. They don't want to go back to the Eisenhower Republican or the George H.W. Bush Republican, where they would blush and could not tolerate somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert or Donald Trump, right? it's a very different conception. So even though they're talking about going back in time, they're, the world is changing and they are changing the world, right? Now, I think a lot of this also comes down to race, right? So there's a lot of race and ethnicity that is driving the let's go back in time. And it's not necessarily grounded in the religious doctrine. Like, these aren't purists going to say, let's go back and be fundamentalists, right? That's a very, very different movement than from where it was in the 90s. It's extraordinary.
There's a, like, one, you're exactly right. Like, it is religion being used as a justification for sort of political views. The other part, and I know we need to move on, but the other part of this that I can't, you know, as somebody who grew up in the evangelical community as well, like, I think there's something unique about sort of American evangelical Christianity that makes it particularly prone to this, which is, you know, as opposed to like Catholicism or whatever, like evangelical beliefs are focused fully on like faith as opposed to acts, right? It's belief and not actions that matter. And this article even points out a number of quotes where people, the characters you mentioned say things like, I'm not perfect. Like it's the values that matter, not my acts. Yes. And I think like it is particularly prone, like so many other religions, like emphasize the acts, right? Like you have to, like, you're supposed to take care of the poor and you're supposed to, you know, do good acts or whatever. And evangelical, you know, Christianity is so much about faith as opposed. And so what you see is that playing out in that they're talking about like, you know, sort of pro-life values are important, and like how I behave or how I act is like less important than sort of these kind of core values or this faith. And I think I realize that is a sort of, again, a mutation of evangelical views, but that emphasis on faith over acts, I think, sort of makes it more susceptible to these sorts of shifts as well.
Dramatic shifts, right? They mentioned, I can't remember the name of the member of Congress, but at a prayer breakfast mentioned that, you know, she was basically living with her partner, they weren't married, and talking, referencing premarital sex at a prayer breakfast, right? Which is something Ned Flanders would not approve, Phil, you know.
Of course not.
This shouldn't be surprising us, and it's not surprising to any of the sociologists, right? This is, society moves and is ever evolving, but it's fascinating to just take a step back and compare where that movement was 20, 35 years ago. So, all right, well, let's transition.
All right, so let's turn to another example of values being reshaped in the political realm. So as we enter the sort of true election season, one shift that has become clear is Donald Trump's full-throated embrace of January 6th. Now, Trump was never exactly super critical of January 6th, but he did early on claim, like on the day after January 6th, he did release a statement saying he was outraged by the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem of the heinous attack on the United States Capitol. He even stated that to those who broke the law, you will pay. So, you know, even though he was never, it didn't feel like he believed, he at least felt like he had to act, you know, he had to go through the motions of criticizing it. In the years since, Trump has gradually shifted to, full-fledged embrace of the January 6th insurgents. And as several articles pointed out this week, it's become a cornerstone of his campaign. So it's not just that he says it's okay. It's like what he's building his election on in some ways. At his events, he speaks of the 500-plus convict. I don't know if people realize just how many people have been convicted of crimes related to January 6th. Thousands have been charged, but more than 500 have been convicted. And Trump often speaks of them as hostages and promises to pardon them once elected. He, at his rallies, plays audio of the J6 Choir, a group of convicts who sing patriotic songs, convicts from January 6th.
Jail.
And his narrative of January 6th has become completely untethered from the truth, as he argues that police ushered protesters into the Capitol and were hugging and kissing them. Some point to Trump's own indictments as an important turning point in Trump's embrace, but the truly shocking aspect is the extent to which the party has been consolidated around him and this narrative. The AP cited Yale philosopher Jason Stanley, who's an expert on fascism, as saying that, quote, when a coup against the democratic regime happens and it's not punished, that's a very strong indicator of the end of rule of law and the victory of that authoritarian movement. So, Bill, what you see here is like this like rewriting of the January 6th is it's insane, right? But we're again stuck trying to make sense of something seemingly unfathomable. So how has this happened? Is this an effective strategy? Like, where do you want to talk about with this?
Well, I think those are both great questions, right? I've been trying to grapple with whether it's a good strategy or not. And then when we think about that, is it a good strategy for Republicans or is it a good strategy for Trump? We can circle back to that. But let's come back to this, you know, the national anthem and Trump plays this, the January 6th hostages, as he refers to him, or political prisoners. They're singing this. And most recently, this last weekend when he did this, he was saluting. So during the entire time it's singing, he is saluting as if they are soldiers, right? So this imagery matters. He is now suggesting that these are like our fallen heroes. We should think of them as this is no different than World War II, you know, that these are the most important people to society. And for me, I sort of was shocked by that because it is a, as you said, it means it's a full embrace of the violence on January 6th. It's not just an embrace of those individuals, but the violence that they engaged in, right? That's stunning. And I'm glad that you mentioned Jason Stanley and all these others. So when you read about individuals who study authoritarianism and backsliding democracies and the transition to fascism, these are the things they point to: rewriting history, embracing violence, turning the violent into heroes. All of these things are just so awful, Phil. And I was thinking today, like, how do I, maybe I'm overreacting, but then I don't think there's not a lesser way to react to this, right? This is embracing anti-democratic, authoritarian, violent tendencies that feels very, very akin to all of the other moments throughout history where we've seen this transition. So it's appalling. I'm glad it got some media attention, but he does so many outrageous things that I think it just falls into that one of many egregious things that he's doing. So I was really troubled by this. And again, there's a long list of things by Donald Trump that I'm troubled on, but this is rising to the top.
I think there's a lot of things like this that haven't been getting as much attention. I mean, this is the question of as more light is shed on these sorts of things, as we get closer to the election, will it matter? And that's kind of this question of whether it's a good political strategy. But I think from a political science perspective, you're exactly right. It is shocking to see him praising people who stormed the Capitol. But really, the message is, I mean, the bigger thing, if you step back from it, is the rewriting of sort of what happened on that day, right? Which is, you know, what he is doing is a full-fledged embrace of the idea that the election was stolen. And so these people are heroes. So it's not really about them. It's about this sort of bigger narrative, but it is 100% an anti-democratic narrative, right? That the will of the people shouldn't be done, that these people were patriots for rising up against it, that, you know, that you can't have any faith in the democratic system. Democracy only works. It only has legitimacy because people believe in it. And this is, you know, the impact of that. And it was bad enough to have the president sort of challenge that 4 years ago. But now, as we go into another election season, to look back at that moment, not with any sort of remorse or it should have gone differently, or but a sort of full-fledged celebration of it, it does not bode well for what's coming next. It doesn't bode well for the state of democracy right now in America. Yeah.
No, absolutely, right? And this question of an effective strategy, I hope it is not an effective strategy, right? So I think it seems to me that Trump is doing this because I think he thinks it's going to help him politically and legally, right? It's going to mobilize the masses and try to create some sort of protective buffer, even a violent vigilante group to protect him. But I can't imagine when we get to the general election that moderates, you know, the so-called independent voters who can't decide between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, which I still can't wrap my head around how there are people out there in that sort of space, but that they're going to say, like, yeah, the guy who's rewriting history about January 6th, the guy that's saluting these prisoners, seems like the better choice. It strikes me as a bad political strategy, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I hope I am wrong.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think it's important to realize, we've talked about this with, you know, Vladimir Putin and others, like when we talk about whether it's rational or smart or whatever, it really depends on what you mean by that. And I think you're right in that there's a difference between whether this is like a good strategy for Trump and whether this is a good strategy for Republicans. There's also the question of, is this smart legally? Is this smart politically? From that, like a PR standpoint, I mean, I agree with you. I think like this kind of insane version of the story, I don't think is good for Republicans. Like I think in the long run, this is detrimental to Republican arguments, but it might work for Trump in terms of, you know, again, if you can get an angry enough mob behind you, that has potential political and legal wins. And I think part of it is by rewriting the story of January 6th, he helped sort of rewrite his own story. So if these people are patriots who are just, you know, believe that a wrong was done to them and they were escorted in, if they didn't do anything wrong, then he's off the hook for what happened on January 6th as well. Yep. So I think that legal strategy sort of makes sense. The other part of it, I think, is like we do the part of me that worries that it might be effective is that we do live in this social media, you know, snippet of, you know, soundbite sort of era. And one of the things we know is that disinformation and misinformation like spreads way more easily than accurate information. And the more sort of over the top or extreme it is, the quicker it spreads. And so if you're Donald Trump, to try to have a nuanced conversation about January 6th and make an argument that, you know, they were misunderstood is way less effective than this kind of insane, they are patriots who should be pardoned and we're going to salute them. That actually is that approach is probably more likely to sort of win people over or to change their viewpoints than kind of a more nuanced approach. And so from a like media strategy standpoint, it might be really effective, sadly.
Well, and what, if he's
do you think that it might be true?
Oh, absolutely, right? I mean, I think because he's going to be looking at his last test case, right? So his case was that the election was stolen, and he knew everybody around him. You know, one thing we've learned is that everybody in the White House at that time knew the election wasn't stolen, but Trump didn't care, and he put this lie out there. And as time has gone by, as he continues to say this, it gets more and more traction within the Republican Party, and a higher percentage of Republicans believe that the election was stolen. So he's probably looking at that saying, like, hey, if I keep saying this over and over and over again, I can rewrite history. Because I was able to rewrite history for most of the Republican Party about the election being stolen. So, you know, I am guessing that there will be a receptive audience for this. Now, I still don't know to the deeper question of whether this helps him get reelected, right? I think at the end of the day, I think this may get him more traction. It may reinforce the cult dynamic that is the Trump political party right now. But I still believe that if I was, you know, betting man, that this is not overall a strategy that's going to help him win the White House. I hope it's not. If it is, Phil, we're really screwed.
No, I think you're totally right. I mean, I think this is the sort of behavior that Joe Biden wants to see, right? Like the more kind of unhinged he is, the more the easier the argument gets for Joe Biden. The part that I know we need to move on as well, but the part I don't get is like the Mitch McConnells of the world. Like why Trump, I can understand why from either ego or PR or legal might want to go down this road. What I don't get are Mitch McConnell, who's not running to be the majority leader anymore. Why is he endorsing this? Like why? Like thank God that Mike Pence has come out and said like no, but it shouldn't take a literal threat on your life from the president to get you to decide not to endorse him, right? And so it just a little bit of political courage from some of these other Republicans, I think, would go a long ways. But it's remarkable to watch them fall in line behind this narrative as well. When they were there, they were on the receiving end of this. It's
absolutely
unbelievable.
No, it really is. And it's political fear, right? Mitch McConnell knows that if he speaks out more directly against Donald Trump on these issues, his legacy is done. He will follow in the path of Liz Cheney. And I mean, Trump is very effective on that front, right? There are no real anti-Trump Republicans in office anymore. They're gone away. They're either voted out or they're silenced, right? They have very limited choices, and they put their political expediency above the democracy as a whole.
But if you're Mitch McConnell, doesn't like going away at age 80 or whatever to retirement, isn't that more appealing than continuing to deal with this? Like that's the part where there's some level of like self-importance that gets in the way of like Mitch McConnell thinks that it's important for him to be there to do what? I don't know. But yeah, it's bizarre. Like if I'm Mitch McConnell, the idea of never having to deal with Trump again and having to like answer questions about whether I support Trump seems delightful. Right. I see Dick Cheney who came out with his like whole ad about like that guy's terrible. And I think, boy, that must be liberating and nice.
Absolutely. And also history, right? It is very likely that history is going to not remember this moment, Trump and his supporters kindly.
Yeah.
And somebody like Mitch McConnell probably gets that, but is still unable to pull the trigger and move in another direction. So, yeah. Well, we're going to continue with this theme. More bad news, Phil. on Saturday, this is why this is the politics of an extremism episode. So on Saturday, former President Donald Trump held a rally in Ohio where he gave a freewheeling speech in which he used language, which even by Trump standards was shocking. While discussing the U.S. economy and its auto industry, Trump promised to place tariffs on cars manufactured abroad if he won in November. And he added, quote, "Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country," unquote. So he said that multiple times. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. He then went on to suggest that immigrants are not people, specifically saying, quote, "I don't know if you call them people," he said. Quote, "In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion, but I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing," unquote. Then on Monday, he attacked Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer for his criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Specifically, Trump stated, quote, "Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves." He went on to say that the Democratic Party hates Israel. Phil, over the years, we have talked at length about Trump's language. It's easy to tune out as all the same version of, you know, different divisive language. Yet this week's tone feels different, especially given the connection to January 6th, and more dangerous. So what do you make of this? Is this more of the same, or should we see this as somehow different?
I think in many ways it is more of the same, but I think our problem as a country is that we haven't seen it as different. Like we've talked, even with this, like part of the response. So here's what I mean by that. But part of the response to his bloodbath comments was the beauty of how he does this is, I mean, he is much more explicit than what we, you know, when we think of old dog whistle politicians who, you know, talked about cities or whatever, as opposed to talking about race. But he's much more explicit, but there's still this kind of plausible deniability. And I've seen a number of people come to his defense, basically arguing that, you know, it's being taken out of context. Like it's not threatening a bloodbath. He's saying it would be bad for the economy, right? If I'm not elected, it would be a bloodbath for the economy. But it doesn't matter. Like what we should have learned a long time ago is that there is an audience that hears what, you know, there's like this message going. It's just like the January 6th stuff, right? In the lead up to that, where he talked about it and people dismissed it as, you know, just political rhetoric. But there were groups out there looking for signals, listening for ideas. And that's where, when you talk about a bloodbath, anytime you're talking about a bloodbath for the country, if you don't get elected, that is like, you know, setting off alarm bells, because people hear that and interpret it in the worst way, not in the best way. And so that's that. And then when you combine it with any time anyone, particularly a politician, says of any group of people that I don't see them as people, that is 100% like there should be alarm bells there. Like that is, you know, I was going to say step one, but that's like actually like step 12 of, you know, moving towards, you know, mass violence sort of stuff. And so when you start combining these, talking about, you know, immigrants as not people, that there's going to be a bloodbath if he doesn't get elected, that sort of stuff, like it is already, as we know, the pump is already primed, right? We're already at risk of danger. And this is the sort of rhetoric that we should have learned a long time ago. Again, people should not be making excuses for this rhetoric. Even if he, again, at some point in the past, even if Donald Trump meant it's going to be bad for the economy if I don't get elected, politicians, he would have been called out for that language and he would have felt the need to walk it back and clarify it. And there's not that. Like it's doubling down on it, because the message he wants to send is not one of the economy will be bad. He wants to send a message of you know, apocalyptic America and violence if he doesn't win. Yeah, it's just... So yeah, I mean, I don't think, I mean, I think it's more of the same in that Trump uses this style, but it feels, you know, more common, more explicit than it's been in the past. And I think, you know, it's, he's learned the lessons of what worked for him. And that should be pretty terrifying to us.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think you're absolutely right to say it's similar but different, right? And I think about it. So we think about the categories of language he's using, right? So it's dehumanization. He's been doing that for a long time. What's different about this is literally saying they're not people, right? So if we think about as we dehumanize individuals, there's different ways you can do that. And he's done that in previous versions. I think this is the first time that he has said immigrants aren't people, right? And we should, the implication of that is that if they're not people, if they don't matter, then if we do brutal things to them, it doesn't matter, right? So if they're killed trying to cross the border, or if we create these awful policies for them, or if we deport them, put them in cages, it doesn't matter because they're not people, right? So it's the same, but it's amped up. It's a higher level of dehumanization. I think the same thing with the way in which he talks about violence. So Trump has talked about violence since the beginning of his first campaign. But when you are literally talking about bloodbaths, that's an acceleration of that language. So yes, it's the same, but I think it's more intense now. And part of that is I think he realizes the gravity of things. And so he's all in on this sort of dangerous, hateful rhetoric to mobilize, you know, those who want to see January 6th in a different way and those who are willing to use violence. So it's troubling. And I love that he'll play this off as, I was just talking about e-vehicles, right? You know, I was talking about the economy. And this is something he's done throughout. He says awful, horrible, hateful things and then says, no, you misinterpreted. I was talking about something else. But to your really important point, that's not the case, right? He's doing both at the same time. He's creating an out for himself to explain away the language while he uses the language for the intended effect, right? It's very strategic in how he does this. So Trump isn't a particularly smart man, but he knows how to find these buttons and push them in the most outrageous ways.
Well, and we've talked before. I mean, this is yet another way of, you were talking about how it gets worse and more extreme. You know, this is another way of sort of shifting those norms or the window of what is acceptable. And so early on when he talked about, you know, whatever, arresting or beating up the, you know, protesters, people sort of laughed it off. And that starts to normalize the discussion of violence. And over time, we've gotten so used to it from Trump that he's able to say they're not people and it's going to be a bloodbath. And we now are used to it, right? It's the I feel like I use that analogy all the time, the frog in the pot, right? Where you're turning up the heat slowly and you're eventually boiled alive. And it feels like that's you know, what's playing out here as well. So yeah, even the other comment about, you know, they're not people. You know, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. Again, I'm sure he would say that he's talking about like the worst, you know, the criminals who are coming across or whatever. But first of all, that should even that should be concerning, right? Just because you have committed a crime doesn't mean you're not a human. But again, it's, you know, he has couched it in a conversation about immigrants broadly, right? And then says that they're not. So again, it is this painting with a broad brush. Of violence and hate and dehumanization, and then trying to claim that that's not what he meant, when everyone knows what he means, right? His listeners know what he means.
I even think that argument extends to the comments about Jews who vote Democratic, right? I mean, so this is really about the right that Israel should have the right to use any level of violence it wants to against Hamas, because if we extend this, they're not people either, right? And if you are a Jew who votes Democratic, you should be ashamed of yourself.
You're not,
and it's really sort of
either.
Shocking language, right? Exactly. Yep. I mean, it's stunning. I think this is particularly stupid, right? I mean, I think that's not a really effective strategy to alienate a religion like that. But he, again, is drawing these lines to say, hey, if you're not in this particular camp, if you don't allow Israel to do whatever it wants in terms of full-throated violence against Hamas, you know, you also aren't, you know, you're not legitimate. It's really, I think that one is dangerous and stupid. I can't imagine that's going to work well, play well. And Republicans were kind of running away from that in mass today, but it's still, he is all in on this.
I mean, all of this fits into what we've talked about before the idea of cosmic war, right? Where politics is reframed in terms of good versus bad, right? And if Donald Trump is good, then, you know, immigrants and Democrats and, you know, whoever else is on the side of bad, it's not good or bad. It's good versus evil, right? And if they're evil, then we're justified in doing whatever we have to. And so this black and white approach to things, you know, that again, if you vote Democrat and you're Jewish, you hate your religion is not a nuanced approach to things, right?
That's right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, all of these connect to like our previous topics, right? We're seeing sort of these lines that are being drawn, but also the way in which they're rewriting norms about this. This is, you know, I guess Trump would define himself as a Christian, is telling a Jew how to be a good Jew. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
I mean, go ahead.
I was going to say, and I think it connects to this idea of politics as well, right? Is this more about religion or is it more about politics? And here's an example where this is clearly politics that you're painting religion over.
Yep. I think all of this is like people point out that these undercurrents of anti-immigration and white nationalism and all these other things were there before Trump came along. And I think that is true. I think he capitalized on it. But I think the stuff we're talking about today shows the importance of a figure like Trump who can, again, when let into the party, sort of normalize all of this behavior. So like whether we're talking about the profanity or the embrace of anti-democratic, attacks on the Capitol, or whether we're talking about the use of violent and dehumanizing language, like Trump, like some of that stuff was present in the United States, but Trump has like made it okay, like has normalized it for political conversation. And that's it just shows, you know, the impact of one person on that stuff.
That's such an important point. So yeah, no, this is we keep going, but we got to talk about the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Democratic Party, where there's also a bit of a battle over the soul of the party, but one that's playing out in a pretty different way than the Republican Party. As we work our way through the primary season, a phenomenon of protest votes has emerged in the Democratic Party. Although Biden is essentially unopposed, a sizable number of voters have chosen to vote for either minor candidates or have declared themselves uncommitted in states where that's allowed, or there have been campaigns to write in Gaza or stuff like that. The New York Times took a look at these voters and tried to understand where these protest votes were coming from. And it's really interesting. It's a short article, but it's an interesting article. And the answer they came to was essentially young voters, Muslim Americans, Latinos, and in some places, Republican voters who are still registered as Democrats, what the article calls dinos, Democrats in name only. The latter, that group, the Republicans who are registered as Democrats, is the least interesting to me. I mean, it does indicate, you know, it's sort of a relic of shifting demographic and political patterns in the South and whatnot. But Biden's struggles with young voters and minorities is a real alarm for the campaign, as both groups are key parts of the Democratic coalition. It remains to be seen whether these voters will eventually fall in line and support Biden in a general election, but it's worth noting that these protest votes are sizable, as much as 20 to 30% in some states. And those were particularly in states where there were sizable, like Muslim populations or whatever. When the typical election, so 20 to 30% in some states, when the typical election only sees about 7% of the votes go to protest candidates. So, Bill, you know, how surprising is this? How worried should Biden be? And does it tell us anything about the difference between disgruntled Democrats and disgruntled Republicans who seem to be handling things a little differently?
I think that last point is very, very revealing. And the answer to that is yes. And we could just move on from there. But no, I think this, you and I, we're in the college classroom. So we see young people, and this is, you can feel this, right? You can feel the frustration among young voters. And I think for many of them, the issue of Israel and Gaza is a dramatic one, right? I think they're struggling with that. They're very frustrated with the Biden administration on that. But I think it extends beyond that. And what I'm trying to figure out is the point that you made. Is this sending a message to the Biden campaign to say that, hey, we are frustrated with this policy, but as you noted, we'll get in line because we see Trump as a graver threat? Or is it a frustration with the entire political system? And it's probably too early to know. My sense is that when you get closer, a lot of these voters are likely to get behind Biden, maybe reluctantly, as they did in 2020, but maybe not in the numbers that Biden needs. I think that's a really really critical dynamic. And I think the Biden campaign and the Biden administration needs to find a way to solve Gaza now, right? Yeah. It's been way more impactful than they anticipated. It has real traction in the American public. So they've got to find a way to get the violence down there. The other really interesting thing is the Hispanic vote. I think that's maybe more difficult for the Biden campaign because you have seen Hispanics drift away from the Democratic Party and in non-trivial ways, right? I don't know if it's easy for Biden to pull those voters back. And I think it reveals that I think the Democratic Party at times lumps all minority groups into one category. Yep. And what we're seeing is there's diverse issues depending on which group you're talking about. And there's diversity within those groups. And I think Democrats have not done a particularly good job of connecting with Hispanic voters. And some of this protest vote is that, saying that we're not particularly excited by what Biden's proposing. So it's certainly something that I think the campaign needs to worry about. And Democrats at large need to think about how do they address those issues. You're a data guy. So what's your sense on thinking about this through this data?
No, I mean, I think you're right on a lot of this stuff. I think that there is something palpably different about this. The data shows it. Your experience talking to our students shows it, in that, you know, people are really disgruntled with the political system as a whole. And I think the Democratic Party has been not captured, but I don't know, at one point in the past, the Democratic Party was sort of the standard bearer of the working class. And we've talked a little bit about how it's become more of sort of a party of educated elites in some way. And I think it needs to remember to speak to, you know, working class Americans, to minorities, like you said, like this, you know, that you're out there competing, you're trying to win people over to your ideas, and you need to convince them. The young voters and Muslim voters are the most interesting to me, because I think that they're, Muslim voters, I think in particular, this is again where the argument can be made that, like, Trump is, as we saw in the last topic, incredibly supportive of Israel. He's not going to be good for Gaza. But Muslim voters would say, but, like, you know, when you have both of them are essentially, not equally supporting, but Biden's not exactly, openly calling out, or pressuring Israel. So to tell people to vote for the slightly lesser of two evils when it comes to Israel is not a particularly convincing thing. But I do think, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. The other part I think about is young people. And it was really this conversation today, as we were sort of introing this topic, and as you were talking, I was thinking about, the young people who are sort of disgruntled with the political system. But I also see in young people today more of this kind of black and white approach to politics, right? And I hadn't really thought about the fact that, like, our college students came of age essentially in the era of Trump. And I think this is where the sort of Trumpian language and Trumpian approach to politics has an impact, not just on the Republican Party, but on politics in general. If you've grown up in a world in which this is the way politics is talked about, good versus evil, they're out to destroy the country, then you have a much more, a sort of less nuanced approach to politics in general. And so the idea of, like, Joe Biden is unacceptable because he's not fully on board with the fight that we're doing. I think that becomes, maybe this younger generation is sort of more prone to that way of thinking, this kind of absolutist way of thinking, because that's the political world they've come of age in some ways.
Makes me think of a candidate like AOC, who could better channel some of those perspectives, right? On whereas Joe Biden's an old school politician, right? He still wants to talk to Republicans. He still, it's a very, very different approach to politics, but it's also a different way of talking about politics as well. This is a really interesting point you're making.
Well, and from a sort of the future of democracy approach, the Joe Biden approach is better for democracy than an all out, like the other side is. But as long as the Republican Party is running off in that direction, it's again back to this, like, how long do you hold on to norms when the other side is, is abandoning them? It's all deeply troubling. I still think that in the end, the right now it's easy to say, I don't like Joe Biden and I'm not voting for him or Donald Trump. As people are exposed more and more and more to Donald Trump, I think that comparison will be, I don't know, the differences will become increasingly obvious.
I think this is such a great point. So we've had my colleague Suzanne Chadd on many, many times on the podcast, and I keep asking her, what are we to make of these polls right now that show Biden behind? And this, she's of the mind that this is also sending a message. And she said, in some ways, we can't worry too much about them right now. If they haven't moved by August or September, then I think that's something where you have to start thinking about more deeply about what's going on. And has Biden permanently lost these voters? Or is this a moment where voters are expressing frustration with Biden and the Democratic Party about Gaza and a whole host of other issues, but they want to get behind, which, again, a very stark contrast to how the Republican Party is handling some of its more extremist perceptions as well.
Well, we've only got like 10 minutes left and we could spend an hour on this next topic. So we should probably get started on it.
This is a great idea. So this has been a heavy, heavy topic. So we're going to try to lighten things up and we're going to wrap up with one of our favorite games, What's More Stupid? And those of you who've listened before know that we list a whole bunch of things and then Phil and I use our political science skills to determine what is indeed the most stupid. So this week, in honor of the news circulating that Robert Kennedy Jr. was considering fellow anti-vaxxer and NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers for his vice president, we're going to focus on them. And it appears that Kennedy has moved in a different direction. But the fact that he even considered Aaron Rodgers prompted the team here at the Politics Lab to put together a list of all the stupid things that Aaron Rodgers has said. And it's a long one. And so we're going to go through all of this and talk about them. But ultimately, we're going to decide which is the most stupid. All right. Are you ready, Phil?
I'm ready.
All right. So let's just start. Number one, he's apparently anti-sunscreen. Rodgers has liked a post by a former NFL player who went on an anti-sunscreen rant on Twitter in which he suggested that sunscreen is simply corporate propaganda. Now, Rodgers hasn't said anything, but he sure did like that post.
Do you think that he thinks that it's a scam and that sunscreen doesn't actually do anything? Or do you think that he thinks it works, but the corporate propaganda is that you're better to get sun anyway. You shouldn't be blocking it. Which version of crazy do you think it is?
I tend to think he thinks it doesn't work. That would be my guess, but I'm not sure. Because remember, Tom Brady also at one point talked about that he thought you didn't need sunscreen, that if you drank enough water, you wouldn't burn. And I have real evidence, one Phil Barker, that it doesn't matter how much water he drinks, he's going to burn. All right, that's number one. Number two, we all likely remember Rodgers recently slandering late night host Jimmy Kimmel on the Pat McAfee show by suggesting that Jimmy Kimmel's name would be on the list of Jeffrey Epstein's clients set to be released in the days following the show. It was not, and Kimmel threatened some very serious litigation, and Rodgers had to say, oops, I'm sorry.
There's a lot of these stories involve Rodgers having to walk back something right. He said. What was his deal with Jimmy Kimmel? Why Jimmy Kimmel? Why did he think he was going to be on the list of Epstein clients?
Well, I think he was just mad at Jimmy Kimmel, right? I think he was trying to be funny because Jimmy Kimmel has had some fun at Aaron Rodgers' gotcha. Expense, right? So for all of the things that we're going to talk about, and Aaron Rodgers didn't like that, and he's the smartest guy in the room, so he's going to take it out on him. So,
I spent a lot of time on internet chat boards talking about how you were one of Epstein's clients. Is that a bad, like, I'm not supposed to be doing that? That's not funny?
I don't know. Different audiences find it different degrees of funny. Okay. So, all right, number three, Rodgers challenged Anthony Fauci and Travis Kelce to a COVID vaccine debate. Now, luckily, Fauci and Kelce wanted nothing to do with this, but Rodgers was ready to go and he was very serious about this, Phil.
That would have been a fun debate to see, actually. I mean, this kind of captures perfectly, you know, Aaron yes. Rodgers thinks he knows better than everyone. And so, yeah, like anybody who's challenging like one of the world's leading experts to a debate on something, it reveals something wrong with your self image, I think.
Absolutely. And Travis Kelce seems like a nice guy, and I'm glad yeah. he's doing those commercials for getting the COVID vaccine. But again, he acknowledges he's no expert. But Fauci. Ooh, I think Fauci would rip Aaron Rodgers up pretty good. So, all right, number four. While the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, he once showed his bare foot in a press conference to prove that he did not have COVID toe.
That just seems
this was when all the
that just seems reasonable, Bill.
Right. I was almost going to put the picture up, but I didn't. And again, this is how Roger's brain works. He's like, let me show you. And there were rumors going around that he had COVID toe. And so his solution to that was to show COVID. Now, this one I can't be too hard on, because if people started accusing me of having COVID toe, I might show my toe as evidence of non-COVID toe. But it's still pretty stupid.
Society would be as repulsed in that situation if you were showing your toe, too. It's just nobody should be showing their feet in a press conference. I don't care what the point is, what you're trying to prove. Don't put your bare feet up on the table in a press conference.
This is political science at its best. All right. Number five. In February of 2023, Rogers embarked on a 4-day darkness retreat in a cave to determine if he wanted to play football anymore. I think he made it 2 days in the cave. This one, I think, is for me pretty high on the stupid meter.
It's pretty stupid. But I also think that maybe I'll pull this one out. And, you know, sometime when I'm just having a rough week, I'll just go on a darkness retreat. And then, like him, I'll just sit in my living room watching TV. And nobody will know that I'm not in the dark. I like
it. That's exactly right. Now, this next one.
How is darkness supposed to help you? Is this a little bit like meditating? Like you have nothing to focus on, so you have to think, you have to be alone with your thoughts?
Yep. Super clarity, right? When you're in a cave for multiple days and you can't see anything, you really understand what's important in life. And that was going to tell him whether he should come back and play more football.
And the fact that he could only make it halfway through when alone with his thoughts, he was like done in half the time. He's like, I got to be out of here. That should tell us something too.
Aaron Rodgers couldn't even stand Aaron Rodgers in a cave. So. All right. So this next one, number six, is also cave related. When asked how he dealt with brushing his teeth in the dark, in an interview, Rodgers said, quote, I came up with a good idea. I put toothpaste in my mouth. I was like, I'm the smartest person in the world.
This is another example of how he thinks he invented squirting toothpaste in your mouth because right. You can't see the toothbrush. Like this is, that he thinks that makes him the smartest person in the world. It's bad.
Anybody who spent a time in a dark cave knows you always squirt the toothpaste in your mouth, right? This is caving 101. So, all right, number seven, when he met quarterback Deshaun Kizer for the first time, he asked him if he believed 9/11 was real. Kizer responded, what? Do I believe 9/11? Why wouldn't I? To which Rogers responded, should read up on that. Kizer said Rogers wanted to do some research on conspiracy theories around the event. So it's not only that Rogers is an anti-vaxxer, he doesn't believe in sunscreen. He asked some serious questions about 9/11 as well.
Yeah, he's got a crazy conspiracy. I mean, this is conspiracy. But my whole thing is, like, if anybody ever asks you, do you believe in 9/11, you should probably distance yourself from them. Right, if that's the first thing they ever ask you upon meeting you, you should just like leave and never deal with them again.
That's right, because you found with your conspiracy theories, you got to work into it, right? You got to build some rapport before you drop the conspiracy theory on somebody.
You got to chat about the weather a little bit, ask them about their kids, and then you ask whether they believe in 9/11.
This is the right way to handle conspiracy theory. All right, number eight. He took medical advice from Joe Rogan, right? I mean, this should be a deal breaker. He went on Joe Rogan's podcast and thanked him for suggesting a treatment that included the horse dewormer as well as the hydroxychloroquine. I could never say that correct, which was, you know, Trump's favorite COVID medicine. So Aaron Rodgers isn't looking to Anthony Fauci. He's going to Joe Rogan, and he's pro horse dewormer. And if you bring horse dewormer up to these guys, they get really upset. It's not just a horse dewormer.
He's doing his own research, Bill.
That's right. So, all right. Number nine is one we all know about. He lied about being vaccinated when he was playing for the Green Bay Packers. He declared that he was immunized versus COVID when he, in fact, was not. And this was found out and it was a big issue. And again, this is Rogers thinking that he can convince everybody by, you know, a little word change, using the word immunized with his own research and his own medicine rather than actually getting vaccinated.
I mean, all of this is like comes around to there's something very Trumpian about this. There's a lot of narcissism, right? That he knows best and knows better and the rules don't apply to him and all that. Like pretty consistent through this.
Absolutely. It's not surprising that Robert Kennedy Jr. would be looking to Rogers for, you know, a running mate. Number 10. Oh,
well, I was going to say that the one that's not even, you're going to get to the last one here, but one that's not even on this list is part of the reason why Kennedy backed away from Rogers was that shortly after this, it came out that he was caught talking about how he didn't believe in Sandy Hook as well. That was, right. And he had to walk back.
Yes.
So that was like a, yet another example of the craziness. Anyway, so get to the last one's one of the best.
Yeah, no, that's right. I forgot the Sandy Hook thing. And that's just sort of upsetting that that does it. Yes. All right. Number 10. And again, one of the best ones. Apparently, Rogers believes that the sound of dolphin sex is healing. In discussing his rehab, Rogers shared, and again, this is a quote, quote, "There's ideas that some of the noises from the dolphins when they're lovemaking, the frequency of that is actually healing to the body," unquote. Again, that's Aaron Rodgers.
A couple of things about this, one of which is this falls under, this is like of the same school of thought that windmills cause cancer, right? It's like the vibrations are in some way, in this case, dolphin sex is healing, whereas windmills are right. not. But I also, it's like, we should also focus on the fact that he described it as lovemaking.
right. No, it's wrong on so many levels, Phil. Oh. All right, for me, the dolphin and the anti-sunscreen are you know, strike me as the most stupid. All of these are stupid, and some are more dangerous than others, right? You know, the Sandy Hook stuff and the 9/11 conspiracies, all of those. Which ones jump out at you as, you know, most stupid?
Well, so again, this gets back to the nuance of what we mean by stupid, right? And so I think like my thought was initially that the things like when you begin a conversation, the first time you meet someone with, do you believe in 9/11 or you have to walk back that, or you're like, you know, you think you know better than Anthony Fauci about COVID. Those are real stupid. But the sort of stupid we typically go for is like, you know, like hard to wrap your head around stupid. It's like, it's stupid. But it's so stupid that it's stupid. And that you're right. The dolphin sex one and the sunscreen is a corporate agenda, or even that he's the smartest man on earth for thinking that he can just squirt toothpaste in his mouth. Those three seem to rise to the top of stupid in a lot of ways.
I agree. And this was kind of a heavy episode. So like funny, stupid is where we need to be today. And you know, the idea that he had this epiphany in the dark when he figured out how to squirt. You wonder how many times he tried to put the toothpaste on the toothbrush before he realized he could just spray it in his mouth.
That was probably what brought an end to this end of his second day. He was like, damn it, threw the toothpaste down, left the cave.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now you referred to it as dolphin sex, and he prefers dolphin lovemaking, right? True. We got to get the language right here. Point. So
I wish that I had thought ahead of time to upload to my soundboard some dolphin noises, but I didn't do that. So you'll just have to imagine them. The listener will have to, you know, insert dolphin sounds here.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we should probably get out of here. This was, Phil, this topic really pulled the episode together.
It was nice. When you go through a lot of really heavy stuff, it's nice to wrap up with something a little lighter hearted. I like it.
Absolutely. All right. So you want to remind everybody how they can stay connected?
You can go to thepoliticslab.com. And we've got, again, articles, the article on the piety or profanity, the one that goes into the data on Biden protest voters, all of that stuff you can find at thepoliticslab.com if you click on this week's episode.
That's fantastic. All right. Enjoy the rest of your spring break, Phil, and I'll see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.